Lightning crashed. A shot rang out. A door slammed. The maid screamed. Let's stipulate up front that is not the writing of our novel writing guest. It's actually Charles Schulz writing as Snoopy in the Peanuts comic strip years ago. But it seemed like a good introduction to the genre of murder mysteries, which is where our guest makes her living. J.A. Jantz is the author of a pile of books featuring three main recurring characters, J.P. Beaumont, Joanna Brady, and Allie Reynolds. And that's not all of her body of work. There's another series of works on the Walker family, some short stories, some poetry. J.A. Jantz is appearing this afternoon at 4:30 at the Ashland Public Library. And tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Springfield Public Library, she joins us on the road from our studio in Reading. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. And I was delighted to hear that weather report because later this week we have to drive across the mountains to Sisters.
Ah, okay. So, yes, this is a good week to do that. Absolutely. So the latest book is Duel to the Death, and it's one of the Allie Reynolds mysteries. So let's start off and teach us a little bit about Allie Reynolds.
Allie Reynolds and I have a lot in common because we both had to sort of reinvent ourselves in midlife. Allie was a news broadcaster in L.A., and she came about because in the early 2000s, I was tired of all of my other characters and whining on the phone to my editor, and she said, well, here's an idea. Why don't you write a book, can be a new character, old character, set it wherever you like, just have it here by the 1st of January, and we'll publish it as an original paperback. It was May.
Uh-huh.
I could write a book between May and January, so I said, okay. They gave me a contract. I signed a contract. They gave me a paycheck, and I had a deadline, and that gave me my second worst ever case of writer's block. May passed, June and July passed, August and September passed. Suddenly, it was the middle of October, and I still didn't know who was going to be in that book. When I have writer's block, I watch the news compulsively. So on a Thursday in Tucson, I turned on the noon news, and my favorite news broadcaster, Patty Weiss, was on the air. She went to work for KVOA while she was still a student at the university. By then, she was in her early 50s. So that afternoon, I watched the noon news. I still had writer's block at 5 o'clock. I turned off on the 5 o'clock news, and Patty wasn't there. And they didn't say she was off on special assignment. She was just MIA. Over the weekend, the other news outlets in town gave out the news that between the noon news and the 5 o'clock news, Patty's brand new 35-year-old news director came to her desk, told her she was too old to be on the air, and escorted her from the building. Within minutes, my character, Allie Reynolds, was being plucked from her news anchor.
It was that fast.
And at the same time, she finds out that her current husband, her then-husband, was a Harvey Weinstein wannabe. So with her whole life in California blown up, she goes back home to Sedona, Arizona to regroup. And that's where Allie Reynolds came from.
That does remind me of the story of Christine Kraft. You probably remember her as well, the TV anchor who sued the station who fired her for being too old, too ugly, and not deferential enough to men.
Yes, I do remember that.
Wow. So so Allie Reynolds certainly comes in with an axe to grind. Is that chip on her shoulder still there through the multiple books you've written about her?
Well, she doesn't really have a chip on her shoulder. She has found a way. Well, for one thing, her husband, her soon to be ex is murdered in the next book, so she doesn't have to deal with that problem. Having a former husband die early on is sort of helpful if you want to go on with your life. But this Duel to the Death is book number 13 in the Allie Reynolds series.
Mm-hmm.
She has a new husband. She has her son. Her husband is several years younger than she is, and her son's wife, Athena, is several years older than her son. So she has a new life. She's She and her new husband run a cybersecurity company called High Noon Enterprises. And she's loving her new life. She has no reason to have a chip on her shoulder anymore. She's over it.
I meant to ask you, J.A. Jantz, about the numbering system here, because while you mentioned this is the 13th Allie Reynold book, there's also three novellas that I guess were just e-books. Is that right?
Yes, they were e-books. And there, two of those e-books made publishing history, because I have two major publishers. The Allie books belong to Simon & Schuster. The other three characters, the Walkers, Beaumont, and Brady, all belong to HarperCollins. And if you've ever seen Romeo and Juliet, sort of like the Capulets and the Montagues, and I was able to negotiate a peace treaty so that two of those novellas, No Honor Among Thieves and Random Acts, contain characters from, are both Joanna Brady and Allie Reynolds novellas.
This is almost like when your favorite rock stars used to get together and you'd see on the album credits it would say, you know, so-and-so appears courtesy of Swan Song Records or something like that.
Exactly. That was just how it was. And writing those novellas was fun, but they wanted me to write a novella that was closely related to the upcoming book. So in Random Acts, Joanna Brady's mother and stepfather die in a freeway shooting on I-17 in Arizona. And so the novel that follows that, Downfall, is leads up from that time and ends with the funeral, the memorial service. And when they published it in paper, the problem was they published it in paperback at the end of Downfall. And so it was really confusing because people who hadn't read the ebook got that message too late.
Oh, okay. So we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. J.A. Jantz, the mystery writer, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, visiting Ashland today, Springfield tomorrow. We'll come back and talk more with her, and you can join us in just a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're visiting with J.A. Jantz, the mystery author. She's written somewhere north of 60 different novels, both on paper and electronic, featuring generally three main characters in her murder mystery series, J.P. Beaumont in one series, Allie Reynolds in another, Joanna Brady in a third. Then there's another series of five books about the Walker family we'll get to here. People who know J.A. Jantz's work rave about J.A. Jantz. She has lots of fans who meet her out at public events, and those events include an appearance at 4:30 this afternoon at the Ashland Public Library and tomorrow evening at 6 at the Springfield Public Library. You can join the conversation right here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. J.A., and do you prefer J.A. or do you prefer Judy?
I prefer J.A. That happened early on when my agent sent my first manuscript. I sent it to her, the first Beaumont book, with Until Proven Guilty by Judith A. Jantz.
Mm-hmm.
But she knew it was a police procedural, and she knew about the prejudices at work in the publishing business in New York. So she changed it to Until Proven Guilty by J.A. Jantz. And the second, John Douglas, the second editor who saw it, was at Avon Books, and he called her up and said, "Boy, the guy who wrote Until Proven Guilty is a good writer." And she said, "What would you say if I told you the guy who wrote Until Proven Guilty was a woman?" And he said, "I'd say she was a hell of a good writer."
Jeez.
And so he bought the first two books in that series. I didn't know I was writing a series at the time. And then a year into the process, marketing got a hold of it, and they said, "Wait a minute. male readers aren't going to accept a police procedural written by somebody named Judy. We want to use the initials. Well, in terms of signing books, it's way easier to sign J.A. than Judith Ann.
True.
And so it was fine with me. But that gave rise to the rumor in Seattle, and they didn't put any author bio on a book, no author photo, which gave rise to the rumor in Seattle that a retired homicide cop writes these books. Then when they started putting my picture on the books with the hardbacks, I thought that rumor would go away. It has not. Now they say a retired Seattle homicide cop writes these books, and she is just a front for him.
Oh, that's funny. Wow. As long as you're cashing the checks, I guess that's all the same, right?
That's fine with me. And those early Beaumont books were written in the early 80s, and so they're legitimately historical fiction now.
Right. So talk about the fascination with crime, and this apparently started with you writing about crimes that actually did happen in the real world.
In May of 1970, my first husband and I crossed paths with a serial killer in Tucson, Arizona.
Your husband hitched a ride with him, I understand. Is that right?
Pardon me?
Your husband hitched a ride with him?
Yes. We were teaching on the reservation. We lived 30 miles from school. We were expecting company, and somebody had to be at our house on the hill. It was 2 miles off the highway, 7 miles to the nearest neighbor and or telephone, and somebody had to be home to meet the company. That morning, the principal called me into his office. I was the junior class sponsor, and the next day was the prom, and the kids and I had decided we would decorate on Saturday, but the principal announced that we would do our decorating after school on Friday. So my husband left school when school was out and hitchhiked home with a guy who gave him a ride to our house. And on the way up the 2-mile-long dirt road, the driver said, "Do you leave your wife out here by herself much?" And my husband said, "Oh, she's got the dogs." Later that evening, when we went into town to dinner, we stopped at the trading post, and I overheard a deputy talking to the clerk, saying something about a man in a green car and something about two little kids. I reported that conversation when I got in the car, and a couple of miles down the road, my husband said, "Boy, I wonder if that's the guy who gave me a ride home this afternoon." So we went back, and we told the deputy who we were and where we lived. At 6:30 the next morning, Jack Lyons, who was Pima County's chief homicide cop, was at our house, and he told us that the previous afternoon, a woman driving to Rocky Point with her two young children, a 4-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter, was forced off the highway 10 miles west of Sells, where we were teaching, shot, raped in front of her two small children, and left to die. An hour and a half later, some Indians coming home from the Heckle Mine in Cass Grande saw these two little Anglo kids walking on the highway. And they stopped and they said, "What are you doing?" And the little boy said, "We're walking on the beach." And the Indian said, "Where's your mommy?" And he said, "She's over there. She's dead." She wasn't dead yet, but she died before they got her to the hospital. So Jack Lyons related that part of the story. He interviewed my husband from 6:30 in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon, and elicited all kinds of telling details that he was able to use to identify the guy later. What Jack didn't tell us, using information my husband provided, he knew who the guy was within a matter of days. But he figured out that he was dealing with a serial killer, someone who killed people at 20 minutes after 2 on the 22nd day of the month, and the woman on the reservation was his third victim.
Wow, that circumstance sounds like something you would only expect to see in a crime novel. And in fact, I remember you saying in some previous interviews that the details, when you related them in writing, people didn't believe the parts that were actually true in real life.
That's correct. I spent the next 40 of the next 60 days on the Hill by myself. I had a 12-month teaching contract. My husband worked construction during the summers. And so I wore a weapon. I was fully prepared to use it. I did use it one day. I fired all six shots from that 22 at a rapidly retreating rattlesnake who was still laughing when he went over the wall. But I figured if the killer showed up, he would present a larger target, and I was motivated.
Ah.
When he was picked up on the 20th of July, 60 days after that event, he admitted to having been to our house on three separate occasions in the intervening time period, and we had been scheduled to be July 22nd.
Oh, boy, the 22nd of the month, yeah.
I could not write that. I had to write that story, and I wrote it out starting in the middle of March of 1982 in this wild flurry of creativity, and I wrote a 1,200-page novel in 3 months.
Wow. That is amazing. What is that, 10 pages a day?
I don't have any idea how many pages it was. It was a lot of pages. And I could remember all of those details in how the desert smelled, how things looked, how things felt. It was all imprinted in my heart. Eventually, I found an agent who told me the book was too long. She said, cut it in half. I cut it down to 600 pages. She still couldn't sell it. And the editors who turned it down, as you said the stuff that was fiction was fine and the stuff that was real was unbelievable. Ultimately, I took what I learned in that case and wrote that into the first Walker book, which is Hour of the Hunter. But when I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program at the University of Arizona in 1968 because I was a girl. So when I rewrote that, I didn't want to write that story in a way that would cause this killer, who was then and still is to this day in prison in Florence, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's still there because last week at an event in Mesa, I told the story, and at the end of the signing, a woman came up to the table and said, that guy you talked about is my cousin.
Wow.
But I didn't want to write a book that would cause him to look at me. So in Hour of the Hunter, the crazed killer turns out to be a former professor of creative writing from the University of Arizona.
So, perhaps one who wouldn't let women into his class?
Yes, that's exactly. So here's the deal. Two examples. The professor in Hour of the Hunter, Allie Reynolds, it's a bad idea to make mystery writers mad. We have our ways of getting even.
You really do. J.A. Jantz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is going to take her long list of books and meet with people today at 4:30 at the Ashland Library and tomorrow evening at 6 at the Springfield Library. She's here on the Jefferson Exchange with us now in our studio in Reading. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to visit, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the professor of the creative writing class at the University of Arizona was an obstacle. I understand your husband was an obstacle to your writing, too.
Yes, he's also dead at the beginning of Hour of the Hunter.
But not by anybody's hand, I should point out.
My first husband died of chronic alcoholism at age 42, a year and a half after I divorced him. Between 1972 and 1980, he was hospitalized 9 times. For chronic alcoholism. So I didn't exactly cut and run at the first sign of trouble.
He
was allowed in the class that was closed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me in 1968, shortly after we married, there was only going to be one writer in our family, and he was it. Well, he was right. There was only one writer in our family.
I noticed, other parallels between real life and characters. J.P. Beaumont, also an alcoholic. Now, he did sober up, though, in the books, right?
He did. But the magical thing about writing is I put that into the books without noticing it. The Beaumont books are written in the first person through his point of view, and he couldn't be at work 24 hours a day. They wouldn't let me in the creative writing class, but I'm smart enough to figure out you write what you know. So when I started writing about Beaumont, I had him doing the kind of drinking that I had lived with for 18 years. And so several books passed. I was in Portland at Lloyd Center for signing books for A. B. Dalton, his long gone. They had me sitting out in the mall with my books spread out on a card table. And a woman came up to the table and said, you know, Beau drinks every day. He has a drink of choice. It's starting to interfere with his work. Does J.P. Beaumont have a problem? And I said, you know, these are books. But in the course of that set of signings, six other people asked me the same question. And I thought, the author is the last person to figure this out, which is how he has his first undeniable blackout in book number 7.
Mm-hmm.
He's in treatment in book number 8. Proof of Life, the most recent Beaumont book, is Beaumont number 23. So he's been sober a lot longer than he was drinking. But I have people who still tell me, I liked him better when he was drunk. I worry about those folks.
Uh-huh.
But there's a young man he's not young anymore because 30 years have passed. A guy in Texas who came to me at a book signing and told me how reading my books in seventh grade my Beaumont books made him decide he wanted to be a cop. And by the time he got out of the army, he still wanted to be a cop, but he was a raging alcoholic. So he got hired by this jurisdiction in Central Texas. They sent him to the police academy, and he said, on the day I graduated from the academy, I realized that if I was going to be the kind of law enforcement officer Beaumont is, I had to get sober. So he went directly from the academy to treatment. And at the time I met him, he had just been appointed police chief in that little burg.
Wow.
But he was there at the signing with a little girl in a stroller, a two-year-old, a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, this is my daughter. I wanted to introduce you to her. Her name is Morgan. My wife wouldn't let me name her J.P.
After J.P. Beaumont.
Exactly.
Right. J.A. Jantz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We have a call here from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
It's great to listen to you. I've read a number of your books. One of the things I wondered, especially for, you do an excellent job, but for many mystery writers, was the portrayal of the senses in getting a feel for a scene, especially if you're writing about the Arizona desert or something that someone has not seen, and the concept of the smell of things and getting a sense for how all the senses can describe not only a crime scene but just the total scene of the character's life. And I find that very helpful in mystery writing, and some people lack it, but yours really have it in your writing, and I appreciate that.
Well,
thank you.
Fortunately, I'm wearing earphones, so my head can't swell too much when I'm saying these nice
things. If we hear a sprawling, we know what happened.
We moved from the farm in South Dakota to Bisbee, Arizona, in January of 1949. When we left the farm, I understand it was 28 degrees below zero,
ooh,
and they had to use a team of horses to haul the car and the trailer we were pulling out to the highway. I do not remember the 5 days we were snowbound in Enid, Oklahoma, but I remember the day 6 weeks later when we moved into the house on Yuma Trail in Bisbee. There's an ornamental fence that goes all the way around that property, and I remember hanging on that fence, staring up at the blue sky and feeling the sun all over my body. That's my first conscious memory. And I think that sense of Arizona is something I try to put in the Arizona books. And in, I try to put the sense of wet and traffic in the Seattle books. But thank you for saying that.
Joanna Brady is actually from Bisbee, is that right?
She is. I had written 9 Beaumont books. I was tired of him. I threatened to knock him off, and my editor said, write something else. So I wrote Hour of the Hunter. When I went back to write about Beaumont, he was fresh again. And so my editor said, well, why don't you come up with a different character? Well, the Beaumont books are written in the first person, which requires a certain kind of discipline. Beau was a middle-aged male homicide cop when I started writing those books. I've never been either one of those things. He's a Seattle native, and I had lived in Seattle less than 2 years when I started writing the Beau books. So when I had the opportunity to start another series, I thought, okay, how about third person instead of first? How about a female protagonist? How about setting this somewhere I know well? And so that's why Joanna Brady ended up in Cochise County. But the other thing about, you can't tell this over the radio, and you can't tell this from my book covers, but I'm over 6 feet tall. I've been 6 feet tall since seventh grade.
Wow.
And so I've always wondered what it would be like to be short. So I made Joanna Brady short so that when I write the book, I have to look at the world through her point of view.
All right. We'll come back and talk more with J.A. Jantz on the other side of a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. Back with J.A. Jantz and her mystery novels in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the mystery author J.A. Jantz, who has written somewhere north of 60 books, generally in murder mysteries. J.P. Beaumont is the longest series at something like 23 official books, plus a couple of e-books. Allie Reynolds, 13 of those. Joanna Brady, another 17 of those. And 5 Walker family books, plus there's some short stories and some poetry. J.A. Jantz is a very prolific writer, and she's in our Reading studio prior to coming to the Ashland Library this afternoon at 4:30 and the Springfield Library tomorrow evening at 6. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what you were just saying, J.A., about trying to get used to Joanna Brady being shorter than you are, I mean, how do you get into that mindset, having been 6 feet tall plus for a long time?
Well, yes, for a very long time, because I am a woman of a certain age. Well, I know things about the top of Joanna Brady's refrigerator that she has never guessed. There are things I can reach out of her cupboard that she would have to use a stool for. My copy editors failed me, and in some books she's 5'2", and in some books she's 5'4", and I think we've settled on 5'4", but she's had a couple of reverse growth spurts over the years.
Okay, she's shrinking. I want to ask about one of the other series, the Walker family series, and you mentioned that actually the first thing you wrote ended up in the Walker family series. You described the process of trying to incorporate tribal stories into the work, like French braiding. This sounds like a bit of a challenge as a writer, a fairly intricate process.
It was actually a vacation.
Really?
Because it was the first book I wrote, Hour of the Hunter is the first book I wrote, that wasn't first person, and it's told through 7 or 8 different points of view over a very elastic timeline that stretches over 70 years, and I would be riding along in one string of story, and that one would stop, so I'd just put that aside and pick up another one, and go with that until that one stopped and picked up another one. And it really was like French braiding a story instead of telling it. And That book was not outlined. That book is published exactly the way I wrote it. While I was on the reservation, I was a K-12 librarian. I told 26 stories a week in K-6 classrooms. And some of those stories were the winter telling tales of the Tohono O'odham, the desert people. When I went to the reservation in my early 20s, I grew up in Cochise County, but we didn't learn anything about the people who had lived in the desert before we got there. We didn't hear about the Apaches. We didn't hear about the desert people. We didn't know any of that stuff. So when I went to the reservation, I was pretty much a blank slate, and I learned so much. And the people were so kind to me. And I wanted to write a book that would make those people who have lived in that corner of the desert for the past 5,000 years come alive for someone who would never go to Arizona or out to the reservation. And so I tried to interweave their customs, their stories, their traditions, all of that into the background of this book. I wrote four of those books. Five of those books. After the fourth one was published, I was invited to come to the reservation to do a book signing. I had been away from there for 40 years. I thought I had treated the people with and their customs with respect and dignity, but I didn't know how the people on the reservation felt.
Mm-hmm.
When we went out there, I was nervous. And we got there, and the whole parking lot was full of Buicks with out-of-state licenses because my snowbird fans had seen the event posted on the website, so they drove 140 miles round trip to come see what it was all about. They were from Michigan and Wisconsin and Wyoming and Iowa. So long before this, during the wine festival on the reservation in 1973, my husband and I were invited to go, but somebody had to stay home with the baby. So my husband went, sat in the circle around the fire, drank the wine, and from that day on, until the day he died, he rubbed my nose in the fact that he had gotten to sit in the circle and I had not. So at this event, the master of ceremonies introduced the medicine man. He did the invocation. I know part of the time he was talking about me. He did it in Tohono O'odham. I know some, but I'm not fluent.
Mm-hmm.
I know he was talking about me, however, because every once in a while he used the word librarian, and there's evidently no word for library in Tohono O'odham. So then he said, okay, this group of young people is going to come out and do a circle dance. It's a sacred dance. Please don't take any photos during the dance. But when we open it for social dancing, then you're welcome to take photos. And if you wish, you can come down and join the circle. So I'm sitting there watching the circle dance, and I'm thinking, you know, Judy, you have griped about this for 40 years.
Right.
Isn't it about time you put your money where your mouth is? And so when they opened it for social dancing and I stood up to go down and join the circle, they gave me a standing ovation.
Wow.
So I got in the circle and I joined hands with people on either side of me and we started dancing. And my heart was just overflowing with joy. And I thought, my life can't ever get any better than this. And then it did, because all of those Anglo ladies, the Milgon ladies from the out-of-state license, came down, and they danced in the circle, too. And I have to say, in my entire writing career, that is the high point, because I made those people come alive for people who would never have heard of them otherwise.
Wow, that's a wonderful story. J.A. Jantz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of 60-plus mysteries. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. I have a nugget, an observation, and a reminder.
Mm-hmm.
The nugget, J.A., is that the reason that most people in southwestern Oregon and northwestern California stay married is that most couples don't have backhoes.
Okay.
And
my question deals with, having written as prolifically as you have to have written yourself into a corner from time to time. How do you write yourself out of it? That's the question. And also, how do you avoid writing yourself into a corner? And then finally, Jeff, it is important to recognize International Men's Day on Sunday. And I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, thanks, Paul. So no backhoe, but how do you write yourself into a corner from time to time still?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
My book of poetry came out in After the Fire came out in 1984, and it's the story of my journey with that first husband. It's not so much about living with an alcoholic as it is surviving living with an alcoholic. But it's a very uplifting book, and the title poem goes like this. I have touched the fire. It burned me, but I knew I lived. It seared me, but it made me whole. He called me. I went gladly, though I saw the rocks, fell laughing through the singeing air. I have known the fire. I'll live with nothing rather than with less. The flame is out. There's nothing left but ash. That book was published in 1984. In 1985, I did a poetry reading where I met my second husband, the good one.
Mm-hmm.
We met at a widowed retreat and discovered our first spouses had died on the same day of the year, 2 years apart. They both died a few minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve.
Wow.
If I put that coincidence in a book, the editors would squawk like
crazy. Right. Yeah, this can't be real.
He's a retired electronics engineer, and so I was writing an Allie Reynolds book, Stakes. What is that book?
Oh, let's see. Allie Reynolds. Deadly Stakes.
Deadly Stakes. Thank you. Early this morning. Sorry.
Yes.
I was writing that book, and I did just that. I wrote myself into a corner. And so finally, in desperation, I went to Bill, my husband. And I said, would you read this and tell me how to fix it? I can't figure out how to end this book. So he read it, and he said, and this is a direct quote, well, why don't you do it the easy way? And so I did.
You're well matched.
With Allie's company being a cybersecurity company, there's a lot of cyber in the background. And Bill, a retired electronics engineer, is my source for all things cyber. And in both Man Overboard and Duel to the Death, I had to learn a lot about artificial intelligence. And again, just as the caller said, in putting the feel of the air and the smell of the desert into the books. For those books, I had to take a very complex issue and try to boil it down into something that people who are just barely learning to use their computers could understand. And one of those people was my editor in New York. I sent the manuscript for Man Overboard, where the serial killer's partner in crime is an artificial intelligence that he created. And yesterday I read an article about how AIs can go crazy because the algorithms take on the prejudices of whoever made them. Well, Frigg, in my book, is an AI created by a serial killer, so she's bound to be sort of problematic.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
So I sent the book to the manuscript for Man Overboard to my editor in New York who, like me, is a woman of a certain age who only uses her BlackBerry. And I was sure that when she was halfway through the manuscript, she was going to throw it over her shoulder and say, call Judy, get our money back, we're not going to publish this. Well, at the end of the book, Stuart Ramey sees how dangerous Frigg is, and he takes her offline and puts her out of her misery. Well, what happened is my editor called me, and she said, what happened to Frigg? Ramey cried, don't kill Frigg. So Frigg is back in Duel to the Death.
And that is the latest book, we should point out, just out last week. J.A. Jantz, we just have about a minute left. Is your brand that distinct that if we ripped the covers off your books and redacted all the names, people who know your work would still know it's you?
Yes, I think they would still know it was me. And I think if I tried to hire a team of writers to be ghostwriters for me when I'm gone, I think they would instantly smell a rat. And so once they pry my gnarled hands off the keyboard of my last book, when that happens, I will be over. Just like Sue Grafton ended at Y, I will end wherever I work off.
You show no signs of slowing down. It looks like you're still cranking out a book and a half to 2 books a year.
2 books a year. I've done that since 2000.
Wow. That is a prodigious output. Well, you have lots of fans who greet you all along the way. The appearance is in our neck of the woods, 4:30 this afternoon at the Ashland Library, and then tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock at the Springfield Public Library. Welcome to the region. Hope you enjoy the visit.